Wolf versus Massey. Ms. Armstrong, you have 15 minutes to argue this. Do you want to reserve any of that time?
Your Honor, may I reserve 3 minutes?
You certainly may. And as we get started, let me just, out of the box, ask you about the procedural posture of this case. You know, the Commonwealth has, as I read the brief, has conceded the lack of jurisdiction, but I guess my question would be, I guess the assignment of error here was framed by the local Commonwealth attorney, is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
And what troubles me about that is rule, excuse me, I'm fighting allergies here, but rule 5A:12 requires that the assignment of error must address the actual findings or rulings of the court. And if the assignment of error is insufficient in that regard, the appeal has to be dismissed. And what apparently occurred here is that the Commonwealth attorney in his or her assignment of error asserted a constitutional basis for the court's ruling when the transcript clearly reveals that the court expressly said that its ruling was based on evidentiary grounds. So where does that leave us in terms of the 5A:12 issue? I don't think that was addressed in your brief.
I think, Your Honor, the only argument that I can suggest to the court with respect to the 5A:12C issue is that the hearsay rule is coextensive with the Sixth Amendment right to confrontation, and so they are inextricably bound together.
That hasn't been true since Ohio against Roberts was overruled by Crawford against Washington in 2000.
Well, I think the case law in Virginia is that those things are the same. That, I mean, in Longshore, my suggestion to the court is that Longshore says that they are coextensive, and post-Crawford, this court and the Supreme Court of Virginia has said that we don't need to revisit that. That it satisfied the hearsay rule satisfies the confrontation clause issue.
Well, I guess
I understand the court's question, Your Honor.
Listen, the Attorney General's office, I think, has handled itself honorably here. By the way, you've conceded the jurisdictional point, but it disturbs me, frankly, because I think the Commonwealth Attorney's office is being a little disingenuous here trying to get this court to take this appeal when, as I understand, you're conceding we don't have any jurisdiction to do so. Is that correct?
That is our interpretation of the statute and the case law. I mean, we also have acknowledged that the court isn't bound by our legal concession.
But that's true. You know,
that is the concern, and obviously we have candidly,
I have serious doubts that the trial court was correct in applying the rules of evidence here, but if the case can't be properly presented to us, it doesn't matter. We just can't consider that the merits of that.
Well, I understand that, Your Honor, and if I could just say, it is very plain, I think, and really not subject to debate, that the trial court below got the law wrong in this case. This is a clearly erroneous ruling, and I understand that the issue before the threshold issue, though, for this court is whether it's an erroneous ruling that can be addressed in this forum. I understand that.
Your position cannot be.
Ms. Armstrong,
our position is.
Haley, yeah. I think in Schneider v. Commonwealth, 47 Virginia F. 609, our court stated as follows. Our law regarding the admissibility of preliminary hearing testimony has always required unavailability and an opportunity to cross-examine and complies with the new requirement of Crawford without alteration. Is that basically your argument here?
Exactly, Your Honor. Exactly so. That those two things essentially are and always have been, as a matter of Virginia law, coextensive.
Yeah.
Yes, that is the argument. And going to the merits of this point, I mean, it just says an opportunity. It doesn't say that it has to be the fullest possible opportunity. The Constitution doesn't require that. The Supreme Court of the United States in Green acknowledged that preliminary hearings are more limited. Plainly, I think we all can recognize, just as a matter of common sense, that we're not going to have the benefit of the witness's demeanor in a situation such as this. Notwithstanding those difficulties or shortcomings or however we wish to describe
that,
it.
That goes back to Maddox versus the United States, which has remained the law for since late 1800s. I mean,
exactly
that, you can put in the transcript and in all of those instances, the fact finder is going to be deprived of the opportunity to view the demeanor of the witnesses, and in all of those instances, the cross examination wouldn't proceed exactly as it occurred in the previous trial or hearing.
Yes, exactly so, and it's not in the reported case, but in Schneider, there was the issue about the timing of discovery that has been raised previously as a policy argument and rejected. So the settled law is very clear, and the trial court's error, I think, in this case is manifest, and so that leaves us, I think, with the jurisdictional point, and that's exactly
just
where we
so
are.
I understand, Judge Humphreys, again, just so I understand, your point about the coextensiveness of the rules of evidence in Virginia vis-a-vis the Sixth Amendment, but the statute and the constitutional amendment that permit Commonwealth appeals are pretty limiting in what the Commonwealth can appeal. So the fact that the rules of evidence might be coextensive if the ruling is based on something other than constitutional grounds, that really doesn't bring it within the authority of this court to consider it, does it?
We understand the court's statutory constraints, Your Honor, and that's what we have attempted to acknowledge on brief, and I will acknowledge it here. The language is fairly clear and narrow, I guess, in its scope. That's where we are.
Okay.
Unless the court has other questions at this point, I will yield.
Okay. Ms. Mosley?
Yes, thank you. I can briefly address the jurisdiction issue if the court would like to hear it.
I assume you agree with the Commonwealth that we don't have jurisdiction to hear this appeal, this interlocutory appeal.
I'm sorry?
I said I suspect you agree with the Commonwealth that we do not have jurisdiction to consider this interlocutory
appeal. Yes, that
appeal.
Is correct. And I can go through those arguments if the court would like, or skip to the merit section if that's all that you would like addressed at this point.
Well, Ms. Mosley, this is Judge Haley. Before we get to the merits, I have a question for you, and I'm quoting from the appendix at page 18, and this sentence is in the memorandum in support of granting the motion in limine, and I quote, "As a result, if the transcript is admitted at trial, Mr. Massey will have no choice but to take the stand in his own defense, something which a criminal defendant must never be compelled to do." How does that fit in with 19.2398 and the phrase protecting rights against self-incrimination? Isn't that what you argued in your motion? In supporting your motion in limine?
Yes, Your Honor, I would say two things on that point. The first is, certainly it was in our motion, and it was an issue that we presented, but the court did not base its ruling in any way on that argument. I think that the record and the transcript were clear that the court's ruling was based on its understanding that this would be a violation of the rule of evidence.
Yes, ma'am, that's clear. But
right.
It's also clear that you raised the self-incrimination question in your motion, did you not?
That is correct, yes.
Okay, thank you.
Sure. I would say in addition to that, though, that even as to 19.2-398, there is no argument that the preliminary hearing testimony that was excluded was obtained in violation of an illegal search or seizure or anything implicating rights against self-incrimination. And my understanding from the language of the statute and the cases is that the issue is whether the evidence itself was obtained in violation, not just whether or not ultimately the court makes a ruling or a party puts forward that argument, but it would have to be that it was obtained. That argument was never made, and certainly the court made no finding as to that. So even if that were a relevant part of the court's ruling, I believe that it still would fall outside the jurisdiction of 19.2-398.
Ms. Mosley, let me follow up on that argument and just ask you this question. Would you agree that Crawford against Washington states fairly clearly that all the Sixth Amendment guarantees is an opportunity to cross, not necessarily effective cross-examination, but simply the opportunity to cross-examine your accuser?
I believe that that Crawford states an adequate opportunity. I believe the word adequate is in there, which I think is consistent with the Longshore case where the Virginia courts have made clear that it's more than a, quote, mere opportunity. It's something more than just the opportunity. It has to be a reasonable, adequate opportunity. And that's what we're arguing here. Not that there wasn't an opportunity. Certainly there was cross-examination done, just that it wasn't adequate given this unique set of circumstances.
Well, as I read the transcript, there were a number of objections posed at the preliminary hearing, but I think all but one of them went in favor of the defendant in the case. So I'm trying to understand what opportunity at the preliminary hearing was denied, how it was inadequate at the preliminary hearing, because I assume we measure cross-examination at the time cross-examination actually takes place.
There are a couple of examples from the preliminary hearing. One certainly is the issue of bias toward the end of the preliminary hearing when there was an objection to line of questions related to the witness, the defendant and the witness's father, and whether they had collaborated to try to help her and to deal with her substance abuse problems, that would have gone directly toward bias, the fact that the witness was unhappy, the fact that the defendant was trying to work with her father to get her help. And, of course, her bias is something really that only the witness can answer. It's, you know, with her death, lost the opportunity for that impeachment, for impeachment purposes for that and her state of mind and thoughts. With respect to that collaboration, that line of questioning was sustained, which was severely limited the impeachment ability. And then, you know, in addition to that, there certainly were other limitations that the court put on cross-examination in terms of temporal scope, you know, how detailed questions could be, having counsel lump together questions rather than go through specific events and instances that he would otherwise have gone through, in an attempt to move that along, that's certainly what occurred. But that was a severe limitation to his ability to cross at that point.
Well, maybe we're getting a little abstract here, but it seems to me that a remedy there would have been to proffer what the expected testimony would have been if the trial court sustained the objection. That would have been given to someone to review, but rather than to bar someone, I mean, surely you're not suggesting that either the Sixth Amendment or the rules of evidence prevent the use of prior testimony of a person who happens to be deceased or otherwise unavailable simply because you can think of some more questions you wish you could have asked them.
No, certainly not. Because you wish you had thought, you know, that there are questions you wish that you had thought of, that you thought of subsequently. But in this situation, the questions that counsel did attempt to ask were severely limited. I think, mentioned in the papers that about 30% of the cross-examination was dedicated to dealing with objections to effectively everything outside of what happened at that time, at the time of the alleged incident. But to the extent that counsel tried to get into prior relationships and other factors outside of that particular evening, there were objections pretty much across the board that limited Mr. Massey's ability to adequately cross-examine. And certainly as to the situation with bias, you know, given that this is preliminary hearing, not trial, and certainly used for different purposes and trying to move that along, I believe also plays some part in this, as the trial court had said on at least one occasion during the hearing that that this was just preliminary hearing, and so sustaining an objection on the basis that that for the purposes of preliminary hearing it was not relevant or not something that was proper to get into at that time.
All right. Anything else?
With respect to the discovery issue, certainly there was a substantial amount of material that we received after the preliminary hearing.
This is Judge Haley. Isn't that always the case? That discovery is seldom completed at the time of the preliminary hearing. Isn't that generally the case?
It can depend. Sometimes it is, but certainly there are circumstances in which it is not completed before, absolutely. I will say that generally there is not the amount of discovery and impeachment material that was contained in the discovery production that we received. And, of course, unfortunately, typically there's an opportunity later to address those issues on cross-examination at trial. And that's the problem here. What we have is just a very unique set of circumstances that I believe very rarely exist, but the death of the Commonwealth's primary witness, together with the substantial amount of discovery and impeachment material that was produced after the preliminary hearing, and as well as the limitations placed on the cross-examination at that time, including regarding the witness's bias, and again, that being the most important witness to the case, something that only she could answer, that set of circumstances, very rare. We submit that given these circumstances, that fairness would dictate that the cross-examination here could not have been and was not adequate, and for those reasons should be excluded. And therefore, we would ask that the trial court's decision be affirmed to the extent that this court reaches the merits.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Mosley. And Ms. Armstrong, you have plenty of time if you want to address any of that.
Thank you, Your Honor. I would like to address a couple of points about the supposed limitation of cross-examination. Your Honor, there were objections that were leveled for the most part, and looking specifically, for example, at page 75 of the appendix, there was an objection lodged relative to Rape Shield and the prior history of these two individuals, and defense counsel himself conceded and said, I'm voluntarily going to limit myself to the date she said the relationship ended. And the court said, that's fine, I'll let you do that. But that was a voluntary concession, if you will, that the defense made, a tactical and or strategic decision that was made by the defendant. That's not really a limitation of his ability to cross-examine. Page 78 of the appendix, there was or 77 to 78, there was an objection lodged. The court asked why it was relevant. Defense counsel explained why it was relevant, and the court said, I'm going to let her answer the question. Page 79, there's another objection, and again, defense counsel essentially acquiesces that the objection was well taken and says, I'll clean up the question. Re-asks the question and got an answer. Page 81 of the appendix, the district court directed the witness that she had to answer defense counsel's questions. With respect to the specific issue of a limitation on the ability to cross-examine as to bias, I don't accept the representation at all. The objection was lodged at page 97 of the appendix. The court sustained the objection, and trial counsel said, all right. There was no effort at all to explain to the court what the relevance of the question was. There was no proffer of the expected testimony, and there certainly was not a suggestion to the district court that it was relevant to the witness's bias. So there was an acquiescence there, and we cited to the court on brief a case from Idaho that the mere sustaining of an objection isn't a limitation on cross-examination. And I would simply note for the court that the rules of evidence are the same at trial as they are at preliminary hearings. If the evidence isn't relevant, it isn't relevant. And there was never a suggestion into the district court at the preliminary hearing what the relevance was. Now, maybe there was...
Without a proffer, we're unable to assess the rulings of the district court in any way, shape, or form. Are we? You know, I mean, we simply can't even address the merits of whether the cross examination was adequate given the lack of proffer as to expected answers.
Right. Well, I mean, in fact, the objection came after the question had been asked and answered, so the answer is on the record. The answer is there. So it's on the face of the transcript. It's on the face of the record. The objection came later, but there was no suggestion that the objection was not well taken. The response was, all right. Whether that's a tactical decision, I don't know, but this is not a new trial attorney. Mr. Loeffler is a seasoned trial attorney with significant trial experience. I assume that he had a reason for not explaining the relevance of that question. And if in hindsight he wished he had, or you know, now that he knows something further, he wished he had asked more, that doesn't render the cross-examination inadequate, and it certainly doesn't mean that there wasn't an opportunity to cross-examine. There was an opportunity. I would suggest, I don't agree that Crawford says that it has to be an adequate opportunity. Crawford says an opportunity to cross-examine. The case law is that...
Doesn't that presuppose it has to be meet minimum levels of adequacy? I mean, how could it be otherwise?
Well, there is case law. I mean, a minimum level of adequacy, Your Honor, I think would be that questions were actually put to the complaining witness. So, for example, where a defendant was not represented by counsel at whatever the prior proceeding was, here the preliminary hearing, then in that situation that may not meet the constitutional standard. But when there is a meaningful opportunity, i.e. he was represented and questions were put to the witness, that satisfies the constitutional standard. Because
I necessarily agree that you're required to ask questions. I mean, hypothetically, I suppose if you had a represented defendant at a preliminary hearing, and on cross-examining, the opportunity to cross-examine came and counsel said, no questions, that still is an opportunity. Now, the tactical reason for not asking questions may be important later, but it seems to me, Reed Crawford, lawyers make decisions, tactical decisions all the time that in hindsight may prove to be unwise, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they constitute a constitutional deprivation of right or a deprivation of constitutional rights.
Exactly. And the opportunity in the situation that Your Honor posited, that still was an opportunity and a meaningful one at that. It's just that counsel in that situation presumably made a tactical decision as to how he wished to proceed in the case. And I think that the same could be said here. Counsel made a tactical decision. Perhaps he was hoping, he was waiting to hold things back to sandbag her at trial to confront her with this prior inconsistent statement, and as things unfolded, it's not going to work out in exactly that manner. The other thing I do want to say is the impeachment evidence is admissible. This statement can be impeached with some of the information that they're complaining about didn't even exist at the time, so no one would have had the benefit of cross-examining her with it at the preliminary hearing. But as to impeachment, that evidence is admissible, and there are multiple instances in the record here where the local Commonwealth attorneys said that they would stipulate to many of these things. So he's not deprived of the opportunity to impeach this witness. He has that opportunity. He has the opportunity to vindicate his rights at a trial. This complaining witness has no opportunity to vindicate her rights at this point in the face of the trial court's decision. And if I can just close by saying the logical extension of the argument that you have heard that he has put before this court and the logical extension of the trial court's ruling in this case is that preliminary hearing testimony or other prior recorded testimony would never be admissible at a trial because 100% of the time the jury would be deprived of the opportunity to evaluate the demeanor of the witness. That is not the law in this Commonwealth. It is not the law as stated by the Supreme Court of the United States, and the trial court's ruling was plainly wrong in this case. And we thank the court.
Thank you, Ms. Armstrong. Thank you, Ms. Mosley. Again, Ms. Armstrong, we really, I think I speak for both my colleagues when I say we really do appreciate the Commonwealth's candor regarding the procedural and jurisdictional posture of this matter. So the court will now adjourn to conference. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.